Hello, and welcome to CAA Conversations. I'm Allison McNulty, an artist with an interdisciplinary practice and part-time assistant professor at Parsons, the New School, in New York City. I'm talking to you from Newburgh, New York, in the Hudson Valley. I live and work in a studio here as a guest on the unceded ancestral land of the Munsee, Lenape, and Mohican, who have lived with the land sustainably for thousands of years. I acknowledge and respect this history, honor the sacred relations of Indigenous people to their land, and express gratitude for the ways all beings benefit from the resilience of Indigenous people and Indigenous ways of knowing and being with the land through history, in the present, and into the future. Today, I've invited Kateri Gladys into conversation about the vast interdisciplinary territory she navigates in her work in pedagogy to, quote, encourage others to look more closely at what constitutes everyday existence, end quote. We'll explore how Kateri's courses in studio art and technology begin creative practice at the intersection of social and ecological inquiry, open spaces and opportunities for her students to practice art based in diverse modes of research and non-traditional sites, and make creative use of resources and unexpected partnerships. Kateri Gladys is an associate professor in studio art at the University of Florida and a transdisciplinary artist who thinks about place, marginalized landscapes, sustainability, mapping, consumption, and agriculture, creating installations, interactive sculpture, video, and relational performances. Exploration and the literal path less traveled inform her art practice. Her mission is to locate landscapes and interactions deemed mapped or known and create alternative geographies that transform how we experience a place. Her work, writings, and impressive bio of national and international engagements and exhibitions can be found at layoftheland.net. At the University of Florida, Kateri has taught more than 10 courses engaging her students with experiments, experiences, and collaborations that investigate practices in agriculture, forestry, economics, and sustainability, mapping and geography, university and community infrastructure, collections, and anthropology, among others. Kateri invites colleagues, researchers, and practitioners from other disciplines into dialogue with her students, leads students outside the classroom and studio into unexpected or overlooked spaces of their research university campus, and navigates neighboring communities and complex regional sites through days-long trips, conceiving and coordinating the funding and logistics of these experiences, mostly on her own or through collaborative teaching practices across the university. I'm always excited to have an opportunity for an in-depth conversation with Kateri, who I can simultaneously call mentor, colleague, peer, collaborator, co-conspirator, and of course, my dear friend. Welcome, Kateri, and thanks for being here to share your experiences.
Hey, Allison. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
So we met around 2006 or seven when I was about halfway through my graduate program at the University of Florida, and you were hired for a tenure track position in digital art and technology. We later became colleagues when I taught for a couple semesters as visiting faculty at UF. Over the years, we've worked together and supported each other's teaching practices, professional practices, research, presentations, and adventures in both place and in art. Before we begin to unpack your approach, I'd like to just start by having you introduce where you are and where you work from.
Sure. I want to begin with a land acknowledgement. So I acknowledge that for thousands of years, the area that now comprises the state of Florida has been and continues to be home to many Native nations. I recognize that the physical space of the University of Florida and the house where I live, and indeed where I'm sitting right now, is located on the outskirts of a documented Pitano settlement and on the ancestral territory of the Seminole peoples. The Pitano of Tamikiwa affiliation lived here in the Alachua region from before European arrival until the destruction of their towns in the early 1700s. The Seminole, also known as the Alachua Seminole, established towns here shortly after, but were forced from the land as a result of a series of war with the United States known as the Seminole Wars. I acknowledge my obligation to honor the past, present, and future Native residents and cultures of Florida. So right now I am located in Gainesville, Florida, which is in the north central part of the state. The landscape is not typically what people associate with Florida. North central Florida is characterized by miles and miles of managed slash pine forests, swamps, and wetland prairies. Where I live used to just be outside of city limits of Gainesville. It used to be more rural, more agricultural, but it's rapidly becoming developed with tract housing and commercial sprawl.
In a statement about your work, you write, "I examine societal issues from the perspective of my lived experience of a particular place, with the hope that what makes one place distinctive informs what is significant and valuable about all places." I've always thought that's such a beautiful phrase, and also a beautiful thought or proposition. In a broader sense, can you talk a bit more about that in terms of where you're based? How does the sense of place relate to your teaching?
I always feel like place should be one of the elements of art, you know, like those things, you know, like in K-12 art, like shape, color, texture, composition, etc. Mm-hmm. Place is a fundamental consideration in any art practice, no matter what one does. I believe pretty strongly that place is both formal and conceptual in any work that gets made. For example, you know, thinking about light and how light changes on depending on the time of day or in geographical location, you know, like the light here in Florida is really different than the light in central Illinois, you know, or the light in Western New York for that matter. Or thinking about the texture of the land, thinking about landscape with respect to both topography and vegetation, and then further expanding about how topography and vegetation is not only about the science of nature, sort of in quotation marks, or natural history, and really understanding how the term natural history is a cultural construct, and how natural history extends to all kinds of interactions between living and non-living entities that inhabit a place. I also think too that natural history of a place encompasses the human effects upon and interactions with the land. So for instance, you know, I'm sitting in my 1970s concrete block house in a subdivision called Pine Woods. You know, about a quarter of a mile away is a super swanky subdivision that contains a small lake called Moon Lake. And everything that I've read, Moon Lake was the site of a Potano settlement and where DeSoto met with the Native people. Yet the public marker that commemorates, again, in quotation marks or italics, the meeting is a mile away on a community college campus. And why is that? So getting back to the original question, an acknowledgement of the history and the land then becomes a bodily experience. And that realization really informs my teaching. Like, I can't not think about place with respect to my research and teaching. Place is profoundly connected to the business and the concerns and responsibilities of artists. When I teach, I really want students to examine and feel places as sites of meaning that inform like what and how one makes.
When first conceiving this interview months ago, I asked you if you could send me a list of course titles and descriptions, including projects and class experiences or experiments with interdisciplinary components, both outside the classroom and involving inviting experts or visitors from outside the arts into your classroom or studio. You sent me back a 10-page document that you estimated probably covered about 80% of the relevant courses. I'm wondering, could you just give us a sense of the breadth of the interdisciplinary scope of the studio art courses you teach in terms of maybe sharing some course titles and short descriptions of a few of your favorite interdisciplinary courses?
And so I want to say that many of the concepts and themes in these courses, and when I talk about these courses, have been integrated into both sort of the graduate and undergraduate components of the classes that I teach. In the undergraduate courses, maybe some of these themes or these ideas are more of a module. And then in the graduate seminars, they're more of a deep dive and there's sort of more breadth and depth. I feel like teaching at both levels feeds the others. You know, often I might pilot a trip at the grad level and then sort of repurpose it for the undergraduates or think about an activity that I did at the undergraduate level and think about, you know, adding complexity and more context and then individual student interests when I start thinking about it as in the form of a graduate class. So probably one of the big classes that I teach is called Mapping and Place. It's in the form of a graduate seminar in the art and technology area. And it also shows up in one of junior senior class called Advanced Experiments. And so what this class does, it introduces to students mapping, thinking about exploration as a methodology for making art. And this idea of using mapping as a way to interpret and situate their work within a physical or virtual context or place. We interface with the local landscape, conduct experiments and interventions with the intention of developing strategies that will hopefully inform the work and the projects of the students in the class. In this class, I encourage the students to look for connections between their own practice and the disciplines of geography, technology such as GIS, GPS, landscape architecture, critical theory, and anthropology, and natural resources. Most of the classes consist of discussing readings, doing sort of experiments. We go on field trips. We work collaboratively. Often I have a lot of guest speakers who have expertise in the areas that we're talking about. And we spend a lot of time outside, and we sort of do a lot of sort of practical hands-on type activities. Another class that I teach that I'm particularly attached to, and it's attached to my research, is called Food, Art, and Technology. And, you know, again, the premise is that we all consume, digest, and excrete. We all look at the notion of food through a variety of lenses. We consider food thinking about the intertwined senses of taste and smell, and how taste and smell, often neglected in visual art, are a material for aesthetic production. And then also looking at artists who are using these media in a contemporary art context. I teach at University of Florida as a land-grant university, and there's a lot of research on food and agriculture here. Right. And so that also, those ideas also contribute to the content of the class. This class explores how food is both an art and a technology. It invites students to think about other senses than sight and touch, particularly smell and taste, as a possible interface that could enrich their own art practice. And we look at local food systems, both personal and industrial, and maybe their potentials for developing relational work. The readings are very interdisciplinary. They encompass philosophy, physiology, social justice, contemporary art practice, critical theory, home ec, natural resources, anthropology, and even fiction. And so also as part of this class, again, there's field trips, we have interventions as consumers, artists and researchers, gardens, cooks, and even perfumers. And all of this is with the hope that these activities eventually end up and inform students' work.
Thanks, Kiri. Those classes sound so fascinating. And I'm wondering, how did this kind of really hands-on experience change during COVID? Were you doing online or hybrid experiences? How did you manage that?
You know, that's a really good question, because I was particularly like, how am I going to do this? You know, when we can't really be together. One class that was particularly, you know, meant a lot to me and I was happy about was a graduate seminar on sustainability and care that was an online/hybrid class. And I really felt like the pandemic and the current political situation in the United States were sort of requiring us to re-examine our decisions about what does it mean to sustain something, both in terms of our personal lives and then on a very much larger level of like planetary relationships. And usually, you know, sustainability is both a progressive and a speculative narrative that encompasses worlds and beings beyond ourselves. So in the seminar, I asked students to reflect upon how sustainability informs art practice, both practically and conceptually. And I really wanted students to make the connections between their personal art project and topics such as like production, resourcing, exchange, transfer, accounting, regulation, consumption, use, labor. And I had a whole like, sort of huge list of vocabularies, things like sustenance, identity, memory, gender, you know, well-being, you know, personal health, and how we could look at sustainability from like all these different sort of perspectives. And then like, how does that come together maybe in the work that people were making or thinking about during the pandemic?
Yeah, I love how you guide students through the strange and unfamiliar and unprecedented and painful and confusing experiences we were all having during that time through this list of vocabulary words, which just helps sort of guide both what's in the cultural consciousness, but also what's in the personal isolated situation at the moment. Could you highlight a couple of the projects or trips or excursions within the courses you just talked about to give us a sense of more specific interdisciplinary experiences you facilitate for them?
I guess I draw upon a set of activities and guest speakers, and not all of them might be in a mapping class in a particular calendar year. And so things that I'm going to share with you right now, some of them are always happen in the mapping class. Some of them are sort of spontaneous and come up. Some of them are periodic. Probably the big thing with the mapping class is a weekend trip to Seahorse Key Marine Lab, which is UF's research station in the Gulf of Mexico. And the idea is we all spend, I guess we get there on a Friday afternoon and we leave on Sunday afternoon. And the students map that island using strategies that we thought about in the class. And so, you know, in preparation for that, you know, I have people like Stephen Knoll from the history department talk about the history of Cedar Key, the history of Seahorse Key, the history of Rosewood. And other times I have somebody, scientists will come in and they'll talk about the natural history and estuary ecology. Other times I've had people come in and talk about Gulf fisheries. And then there's other topics that are part of mapping, but not necessarily are specific to that trip. So we've had people from the astronomy department come in to talk about mapping, like what does it mean to map something that's infinite, getting a little bit more local. We've had community activists and people from the architecture department come in and really ask the students to think about, you know, the gentrification that's happening as a result of the university and the development around the university. We've even gotten sort of very like sort of hyper-local and taken like tours of campus infrastructure, you know, from the UF physical plant, or at one point we had the director of the physical plant take us underneath Shands and we wore hard hats and we looked at like the air purification system. We've had the people from the map library come and do workshops about GIS, geographic information systems and remote sensing. We had Dr. John Peterson come and talk about his collaboration with the Chinese master Penjing gardeners, which is like a miniature form of landscape gardening. Everyone needs to learn how to compass in a topo map. Yeah, I think I covered that for that. For food art and technology, and again, that's really often is really spontaneous. And many times there's resources that come with the students who are interested in that class. So like when you're one of the students' moms was a perfume fragrance specialist at a major department store, and they came in and talked about the perfume industry and how to understand components of perfume in terms of thinking about the smell component. We took a trip, a field trip, to go back out to Cedar Key, and we toured a clam lease with Captain Bobby, who is also one of the captains of the boats that goes out to Seahorse Key. So there's a lot of interconnections between the people and the places of these classes. UF has the Institute of Taste and Smell. And so we often learn, like, if we're super tasters, we learn about palatability and food. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff. We go to local organic farms. We've gone to Dr. David Clark's lab, who is a biologist and a geneticist who manipulates the color and smell of flowers and tomato. Oh, no, Dr. Klee is the tomato person. But these scientists at UF who are like on a very micro level, you know, like how to make the best tasting tomato, or how to make the most beautiful flower annual plant for your landscape. We've learned about seed saving, both in terms of vegetables and also seed saving with endangered native plants. You know, we've been really fortunate. At one point, I was at University of Illinois teaching this class, and the Bizziki Culture and Dance Company, an indigenous group, came and talked to us about fishing sovereignty and about native foodways, and made us a really great wild rice dish. You know, we've been to candy makers, once it's like Flesher's Candy. Again, this was the year I was in Illinois doing exchange, where these two sisters have tried to revitalize their town of Arcola, Illinois, with a business that their father had owned, their grandfather and father owned since the early 1900s. I don't know, we fermented all kinds of stuff. We've made jam. We like thought about ramen. We've done some molecular gastronomy experiments, like making agar-agar balls, which is kind of like that boba, the squirting boba that you get at the tea shop. I've asked the students to extract and bring a smell to class, made candy, and talked about sort of the very pretty sordid, horrible history of sugar while like pulling taffy.
Kateri, these lists are immense and just incredible. And I want to highlight, like I'm looking at some of the lists you sent me while you're hitting on some highlights. And what we've been able to touch on is just the smallest fraction of the sort of experiences you coordinate. So one thing that strikes me is these courses and these experiences go so bravely and confidently into different areas of the sciences, social sciences and natural sciences, among other areas. And it just kind of begs the question, do you have a background at all in the social or natural sciences in your education?
That's an interesting question. So I think part of it is growing up, my dad worked for the Fish and Wildlife Department here, Fish and Wildlife Service. So I spent a lot of time on wildlife refuges, learning how to identify ducks, or, you know, just being around for when my dad did maintenance on boats and equipment. When I was an undergraduate, I started out as a pre-med major, and I worked in a sickle cell anemia lab, and my job was to separate hemoglobins from sickle cell blood. So I, you know, for 3 or 4 years, I definitely spent, you know, time. Yeah, I spent time working in a lab. And a lot of my sort of electives that I took when I was in school were things in population biology and ecology. When I was a graduate student at University of Illinois, I worked for Dr. Bill Stewart as part of my assistantship. And a lot of his research was in landscape change, particularly focusing on sort of what happens when suburbia begins to hit agricultural land. How do people perceive or look at or understand what a prairie is? And my job was to collect stories and do interviews, particularly about people's feelings about prairie and what did it mean when a prairie became a park, where prairie became a privileged sort of natural area, and how people understood prairie and their relationship to the prairie, as well as their relationship to agricultural and farmland. And, you know, what happens when farmland and suburban land, when those interests collide, and how do people negotiate those kind of conversations? So I don't necessarily say I have like a background in science by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess I've been exposed to and sought out experiences where I'm forced to think about land and land use. And that definitely has informed my teaching.
Yeah, your students have so many diverse experiences, perhaps not the kind they might anticipate having in a studio art class. How do you prepare them for the experiences they'll have outside the classroom in unfamiliar settings, both in a practical sense of like bring water and bring bug spray, and also in terms of orienting them to discourse and methodologies outside the arts? Also, does this approach differ with different courses and groups of students, however you might characterize those groups?
Sure. I think there's several levels up to what it might mean to prepare students to have an experience either during class time or out of class time, outside of class time, or having an experience that is in an unfamiliar setting or setting that might not be characteristically associated with the culture of school. I guess first thing, and this is from the get-go, is really articulating that there's a larger picture that this particular class is going to focus on, and that we'll be doing activities that are outside the classroom, outside the computer lab, as a way for students to begin to situate their art practice within the context of broader contemporary culture and to engage with a wider community. You know, and certainly, you know, we talked a little bit already about, you know, going to Seahorse Key and doing overnight trips. But there's like a lot of baby steps that kind of lead up to the overnight trip, you know, on an island research facility that's only accessible by boat in the Gulf of Mexico. I really feel like there needs to be time where we do activities that are associated with school, like reading and discussing writings on topics related to the course's content, so that everyone begins to have a vocabulary or expands and enriches their vocabulary with ideas that would potentially inform the content of students' work. But also in sort of doing these sort of readings and looking at work, begins to have students think about an environment that's conducive to taking, okay, ideas about art and then putting them together with, let's say, ideas about science or the social sciences. having those people come in and speak with us is really about creating learning experiences where students begin to directly interface with the community or researchers who are experts in topics associated with themes of the class. So like it becomes this expectation that, you know, if you're going to, let's say, make art about trees, well, maybe it'd be a good idea to talk with a forester. Or if you're going to make art about insects, maybe talk about somebody who's working with insects. And then there's also this idea of encouraging students to think about what they do know and what they are studying and what interests them so that they can make art in and about sort of their local context using familiar tools and ideas, but then applying them to a new situation. So for example, like the seniors in the advanced class who traveled to Seahorse Key used the imaging technologies that they learned about in other classes, you know, such like as video and 3D modeling software. They used those methods to poetically map the island's ecology, history, as well as thinking about human and animal traces in that particular space. So in another class, we were talking about labor and unseen labor, and I orchestrated learning situations that resulted in projects where students shadowed physical plant employees as a means to uncover the hidden infrastructures of our campus. You know, so students would like read about labor and maybe think about artists like Mira Euclides and the sanitation work project as a way to prepare to interact with physical plant employees. And I have to say, you know, like at that particular time, there was a lot of goodwill on the part of physical plant workers, you know, who agreed to making their own jobs more complicated in order to facilitate student learning. And, you know, this particular activity, and the reason I mentioned it, is super bittersweet because in the following year, there were huge budget cuts and many of these people lost their jobs or their departments were farmed out to local contractors. You know, but because the students had worked with the physical plant people, learning about their downsizing began to mean something more personal because of the relationships they developed and the collaborative work they did. In video art, you know, we do an experimental documentary project where students create videos to sort of reinterpret what's meant by the managed pine forests that are ubiquitous in the southeastern United States. So like in this instance, you know, and this is an overnight trip, it's sort of a repeated going to the forest and then using it as a site to make the video. So students will go, they'll tour the forest with a person from the forestry department. And then that kind of leads to, depending on where the students go with their own ideas, many of them will end up having to like research and talk to other scientists who do forest research in order to realize their project. But then on top of it, in terms, I guess we're talking about preparation, there's some really practical kind of things that go in. So like the forest, for instance, like we are in the woods. Mm-hmm. It is Florida. It is still very hot and humid in October. There are insects like ticks, biting flies, mosquitoes at the Austin Cary Forest, which is UF's teaching forest. There's at least three kinds of poisonous snakes and poison ivy, a lot of swampy wetland water that can affect you and your camera and recording equipment. So there's also a great deal of talking preparation about like what to wear, what to bring. And then, you know, the fact that I take the class on a tour of the forest in a very structured way at the beginning of the assignment so that, let's say you wore flip-flops on your first time out after being told to wear closed shoes, experience might dictate that you wear sneakers the second time around. And then 80% of the time, when the students are like, let's say out in the forest collecting their footage, I'm on site doing research and working. The students have to go out with a buddy. They have my cell number to call if they get in trouble because I'm already on site. And, you know, certainly there's a time commitment on my part, but there's some good results that come out of it.
Wow. You provided such a great list of practical and useful strategies. Thank you. And I love how your students get to not only learn from you and with you at the same time, but you also set up these situations where you're almost more of a curator, curating experiences where your students also get to learn additionally from a vast network of people and resources in their community. So you use your teaching, it seems like, to set up situations where these networks become visible. The resources that are already there become visible and suddenly seem available to your students' curiosity, to their practice, their questions, their work. And it's a feeling I remember from being enrolled in your mapping seminar as a grad student, in which I just felt really vividly again just now while you were speaking, where your students are learning with staff, with trees, with maps, with mosquitoes, with professors in other departments, as well as with devices, tools, equipment, materials, software, et cetera. It strikes me that participation in these courses demands a lot from students and does not allow for any kind of passive learning, which I find so compelling. Do you come up against resistance from students toward these experiences in terms of content they're asked to engage with, but did not expect, or the physical demands perhaps of field research practices, the time commitment needed for multi-day trips or otherwise? And how do you navigate those situations with resistance or perhaps even uncooperative students?
So indeed, for sure, I do encounter that. And I guess curating or teaching students how to find networks that inform their art is really, their art practice is really, really important to my pedagogy, but I also feel how artists operate in the 21st century. So how do I navigate situations with people who maybe are not so keen to be doing these activities? Mm-hmm. So I think I might want to differentiate here between people who, you know, have ways of being in the world that require institutional accommodation. And that's not what I'm talking about right here. And I would separate that from, you know, people who are resistant for some of the reasons that you just spoke of. So most of my classes have a mix of people who are required to be there, people who have chosen to be in the class, and then people, although they're required to be there, are into what we're doing. And I'm very upfront with advisors about the expectations of the class. I also really try and listen to what people are particularly resistant to. And if possible, you know, kind of make adjustments. You know, so for instance, our studio courses are in 3-hour blocks. And so if we go off campus, you know, many students get worried and get really anxious about getting to their next class, which is totally reasonable. So like navigating that might require, you know, putting students together who have to leave a little early in the same carpool, or contacting a colleague at the beginning of the semester and letting them know there's a chance the student might be late. It, just kind of ironing and figuring some of all of this out before it happens. And those kind of logistics are pretty common. You know, some activities, they may initially seem like they're too much. Like, so an example is like in the food art and technology class, I've tried to include a service learning component. So students have to go out into the community or on campus and volunteer like at Field and Fork Campus Farm or one of the other in-town organic farms. And granted, I always have the caveat that you could, if you can find another situation and you can tell me how it relates to the class, and if it has something to do with the content of the class, I'm generally okay with it. And some students have gone out, you know, and volunteered, let's say at a food pantry, or volunteered like in other sort of local capacities having to do with food systems. And, you know, I really actually encourage that. But then also too, sometimes when you're talking about people that are resistant, you know, there's somebody who, something else sometimes happens, or someone who thought this was like the worst idea ever to have to go and like volunteer at a garden or a farm. And then they're out there and they're kind of doing their volunteering and they realize like, hey, I'm a senior, I'm in my spring semester, I'm totally stressed out. And maybe pulling a few weeds or like cleaning greens to get them ready for the campus food pantry, maybe is exactly what I need to be doing, and I'm getting credit for it.
For those listening and undoubtedly feeling excited about your approach to course design, I imagine they're also feeling daunted. Can you walk us through some of the other practical logistics of your teaching practice, the process of organizing, outreach, permissions, navigating an overnight excursion?
Sure. So there's a strange balance between like the spontaneous opportunity that pops up and that is totally relevant to what I'm teaching, and then a lot of persistence and planning. I would also say that a lot of this is about relationships with people, with the community, with the other people on campus, which of course change and flow, especially thinking about recent times where people retired or moved on to other places. So in terms of class visitors or people who will talk with the students in preparation, I usually try and get that squared away at the end of the preceding semester of the class or at the very beginning of the semester in which I'm teaching the class. So in terms of practical experiences like wayfinding or fermenting, especially if I'm facilitating like a fermenting activity, you know, there's preparation that I need to do, like, you know, creating the routes for students to use compasses to wayfind a path across campus, or finding the supplies that I'm going to need to make candy or ferment, and then strategizing what it might mean to cook and pull taffy in a computer lab, or can I prevail upon somebody over in the Center for Taste and Smell to let me use a campus kitchen? And then how do I schedule that around people who are coming in to do like corporate taste tests, which, you know, helps fund that area of campus. And then also I have a lot of tarps. And one of the good things in Florida is that winter weather is very temperate and we can do stuff outside. And then I've also amassed a lot of materials and reusable kitchen tools that are in a box just designated for that particular activity and class that I will reuse year after year. With respect to taking students on an overnight or even a day-long trip, students are informed about facilities, sleeping accommodations, climate control or lack thereof, you know, sustenance and food, clothing and footwear, what to expect in terms of topography, vegetation, weather, wildlife. And again, like these aren't only just part of the logistics, but they're built into the content of the class, you know, with respect to the different people who actually come and will talk to us. We might have someone who's a herpetologist and they will talk about the snakes. And in that conversation, there will be a reiteration like there are poisonous snakes on the island, but from a very sort of different perspective. There's a lot of stuff, but it feels like it's worth it. And it's part of the reason I do what I do. I actually like creating and orchestrating situations for learning. Like, I really feel like that's part of my pedagogy.
Yeah, and it's evident that it's part of your passion. All the things you said are just really helpful to think about. Thank you again. Part of what I'm hearing you say is that you're still learning some of these processes that seem like they could have been evident years ago. But also part of what I'm hearing is that you strategize for the long term, that you're building up sets of tools and building your networks and connections across semesters, as well as across years and even past decades, which opens up increasingly more options as you move forward. That brings us, I think, to like another very important practical concern is, how do you fund these trips and how do you approach compensating collaborators, visitors, all of these experts in your classroom, as well as just people working in your community, often in rural areas of your community? Are students contributing to the cost of these trips through course fees, say, or otherwise? Do you find underwriters, grants? And are there any other obstacles you routinely come up against?
So I definitely sort of, in quotations, rely on the kindness of strangers. And with the responsibility of me personally having to pass it on with one of my collaborators or just to the universe in general, in terms of compensation, there's been times I've paid people out of pocket or done trades. You know, recently, and I'm incredibly grateful for this, the school has made funding available for small outlays of cash, like $200 here and there, to compensate sort of local collaborators. At times, some of the farmers and the farms that we've done tours at, they've requested some sort of service in exchange for them having to take time out to talk to them. I was doing a teaching exchange in Illinois. One farmer had us, after the tour, had us pull off and roll up plastic and freeze cloth at the Southern Heritage Seed Collective here in town. You know, after they talked to us, they had us sort and package heirloom seeds for about 45 minutes. After having a community activist come in and talk to us about the gentrification that's occurring in the neighborhood where the grad studios are located, many of the grads came out and did these surveys at the request of neighborhood leaders at a local arts festival. And these surveys would then be used by the Neighborhood Arts Coalition as data for grants. I'm an affiliate faculty at the School of Forest Resources and Wildlife Conservation. And because of that, I get a break on the cost of going to Seahorse Key. Otherwise, in those situations, students split the cost of the fuel for the boat and the generator for the lighthouse dorm space. And we do food as an organized potluck. But again, you know, if a student drops out or if I can't keep the cost of the weekend for under 50, or if someone simply can't afford it, the funds are out of pocket. Occasionally from the university, I will get a grant specific for pedagogical interdisciplinary collaboration. So in speaking of this, I'm not criticizing any one person or entity. Like, it's just sort of the landscape of how it is to do a lot of this kind of work.
Yeah, I know that's a real challenge. And I know also the out-of-pocket model is problematic for a few reasons and not sustainable. but it's a fallback plan that you're both fortunate and generous to make use of. In contrast to the reciprocity model, where students are not only learning something about the ins and outs of the work related to their visits and studies through hands-on jobs, but also learning something critical about how the world works or how service, exchange, and the value of time and labor in a different way. I love that model of exchange and reciprocity, and also how that has the potential, I think, to push at the edges or bounds of what we consider higher education and the monetary cost of higher education. We could have a whole nother conversation about that another time.
Are there
some trips, experiences, or projects that you've been very excited about, but have ultimately not worked out well or produced the outcomes you've aimed for? What do you learn from those, and have those approaches changed over the years?
Of course, there are times when things do not go as I would like. Although it's been many years, I'm recalling the Withlacoochee River kayak trip where we were locked out of the vehicle at the end of the journey, and I had to hitchhike with a student back 10 miles up the road to get the vehicle, other vehicles, and the keys. You can decide to speak to that or not. And I, you know, now do triple and quadruple checks to make sure that everyone has keys and the keys are in safe places.
I remember that kayaking trip. I was on that trip in which the key got lost, and I'm sure my stress level and experience of it was as a student was much different than yours. It's actually quite a fond memory of a group of us students sort of having a moment unplanned in the midst of the trip. While for you, I'm sure it was very stressful to return and get that key. Are there any others that you wanted to talk about?
So other failures in quotation marks have been what I might consider like less than civil conduct on part of some of the students in the class towards community people who are sharing with us. So like one year, as part of the food and technology course, about a third of the class was very organized in their displeasure at being required to take a class in the art and technology program and have to go on a field trip to a farm. In particular, they didn't want to sort seeds, and they made their attitude very evident and very public. And, you know, I felt horrible about it. I apologized later to our host, who fortunately is a person who I've had a, you know, years-long relationship with and who I've collaborated on other projects. And they didn't judge me on that particular experience. These same people were upset about the service learning and volunteering for the farm. And then they mentioned privately that it was great not to be in front of a computer all day and get free veggies. So I don't know. It's not necessarily always a failure. I mean, that's the word we use, but more like what I learned over time. And one of those things is to make space around experiences for students and even myself to process, connect what we're doing to art practice and integrate.
Yeah. Some, though not all of these experiences have physical components that can be both unexpected in a college art course, but also perhaps physically demanding for the students. They involve walking, as we've heard, trekking, kayaking, embodied field research, other things. So how do you navigate issues of accessibility in these experiences? And where do you leave space and opportunities to accommodate students who may need to participate in different ways?
I have to say, I handle this in the same way I handle accommodations in the classroom. You know, I sit down with the student one-on-one and, you know, ask about how they want to handle the situation. I also get guidance on safety and my responsibility and the institution's responsibility to the student from campus disability services. Because the topics or the themes for the projects can encompass a wide variety of topics, you know, across a whole region, there's often a lot of content to work with. I try and have these conversations with students early. I do have these conversations with students early. It's even part of the confidential questionnaire survey that I give the students at the beginning of each semester that seeks to find out about their comfort with being outside, being physical, and their technical skills. Many of their students will go on their own to these places. So it's sometimes it's easier for them just to go in their own car. Other students will use materials that are online, like weather, water, and wildlife inventories or archives, and repurpose research that's publicly available to create amazing projects. For instance, one student who wasn't able to come this spring used water current and satellite aerial images and AI to make a film about the fecundity of estuaries. And the piece was recently chosen to be part of an exhibition in New England about the ocean.
Besides collaborating across the university and with groups or individuals in your community, I also see you in your own practice and in the design of your courses, instigating relationships with and working collaboratively, not only within, but with landscape, place, natural forces and processes, soil, plants, trees, animals, water systems, and many other entities entangled with human pursuits, needs, and culture. But how do you think about your work with non-humans? How do students engage with this aspect of the experience you coordinate for and facilitate for them?
I'm really interested in engaging with the non-human, especially plants, particularly in my own research. You know, there's a lot of buzz and conversation about considering the non-human. And I think that that actually has some undergrads and many graduate students excited. Surprisingly, or maybe not so much, with the undergrads, thinking about the non-human surfaced in the sensor-based electronic art course that I teach. They used gas and sensor moistures as a way to interface with trees and decaying plant matter. And, you know, in that, I felt super enthusiastic. And moving forward, I want to plan those themes into the class. And that was very student-inspired.
The experiences you create clearly for your students are, and in your own art, are both sensual and mediated. You write, my research becomes a methodology for domesticating data, allowing me to combine my lived experience of place with the imagery and statistical information of infrastructure that forms the foundation of our everyday lives. Your teaching practice is centered in the digital arts and technology department, while your courses are driven by experiences clearly centered in and between bodies. Could you talk a little bit more about how technology and digital media intersect embodied experiences in your approach to art making and teaching in a general way?
So I see technology as a way to make visible what is often invisible to human senses. It plays with speed. It frames what we look at. So we're forced to or invited, depending on how you want to look at, see something we might overlook. It aggregates and sorts via algorithms, vast amounts of data, and give us perspectives that might not occur to us. Tech also sorts out like sort of volatile chemicals that when aggregated, give us a particular smell. Tech gives us access, but not necessarily an understanding of the interactions that we cannot apprehend on our own or that we haven't necessarily been acculturated to access. So I always think about that story where there's a group of non-Western people who believe that the planet Venus or Mercury was visible during the day. And there was a lot of dissing and argument ensued among scientists to say there's no way that these people are seeing Venus or Mercury. And indeed, after researching it, one of those planets that's close to the sun, it was visible at times during the day. So I think that technology has these great potentials. And indeed, I use it in my work, but I also feel pretty strongly that we still have bodies, regardless of what people predict in the future. And our bodies are very available technology to help us understand the world around us, you know, and it would behoove us to rely upon them.
Is there anything you're reading or listening to or anyone you're talking to that orients you in designing these experiences between the embodied experience or the technological experience? What are you using as guidance?
I was really fortunate in my education to have some professors that made me get out and about. When I was an undergraduate class, I ended up taking a population biology class, and, you know, we all had to go to Indiana, I think it was Turkey Creek, to, you know, for an overnight. And, you know, the reason I took that class with a couple of my friends was because we had to go camping. Like that was the big draw of that class. And I think that experience sort of stayed with me as I became a teacher, you know, and I remember on that trip that, there were three of us. There was another student who was an art historian and I, and these other two guys were kind of geeked out. And we all went exploring for caddisfly larvae or caddisfly casings in a creek. And we found them. And that was just like this kind of amazing sort of, you know, being in the water, touching the cases that they make. And then many years later, seeing an artist who had actually sort of trained the caddisflies to like weave gold into their shell, their containers or shells. When I was a graduate student, you know, there was a landscape architecture class, you know, where our professor literally dragged us out into a cornfield after dark and like had us navigate our way out of the cornfield. And really realizing what a sensual experience of that was. I mean, you know, the smell of the soil, the smell of the corn, the way that the corn, you know, the dried corn on the stalk and the sounds our bodies made going through it. And then there was another class, like maybe it was a land art class, where it became okay for me to go and write about and document this like fake man-made mound sledding hill park. And where I was really encouraged, especially in graduate school, to go out and about. And even as an undergrad, one of my sculpture professor person was like, well, just go down to the south side of Chicago and take pictures of slag piles, you know, just go wander around that industrial wasteland. And I think all of those experiences contributed to how I teach. And I guess if we're going to go like in terms of particular programs, you know, I really admire Bill Gilbert's and Chris Taylor's Land Art of the American West program out of University of Mexico, where the students go out in a van for about 6 weeks and explore the region. That class is really field-based and socially engaged. I'm also a big fan of Signal Fire out in Portland. I've been lucky enough to have participated in one of their artist residencies, but I really enjoy reading and thinking about and always want to know more about their wide open studio program, where students go and read, and then they're out in the space making work in a very spare kind of way, you know, sort of as a model for engagement with the land.
Yeah, that's the Signal Fire Wide Open Studios program and residencies are certainly a great reference for the work that you do. But also I know the place where you went camping in Indiana. What's it called?
Turkey Run. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I gotta say, I know the Turkey Creek, Turkey Run area. I'm also from the Midwest, from Northern Indiana, and I very, very much appreciated and could feel in my body your description of being led out into the cornfields and sort of set to find your way back, and can in an embodied way relate to that experience of doing that with friends in high school. And I appreciated your description, so closely matched those memories for me. Kira, I got to ask you, this kind of teaching, it's so much work. It requires so many things in addition to the normal, creating a very effective normal classroom experience, and then integrating what's going on in the classroom, in a traditional classroom culture, with what's happening outside the culture. There's so many steps, concerns, worries. What makes you want to do this kind of teaching? Why is it important?
Experiencing place and engaging place is how I learn, and it's how I end up making work. I mean, it's part of my art practice. And I guess I don't really know another way to teach that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I think essentially what you're saying is it's just a calling, and the authenticity of that and the value of that in our educational system and the world in general is something I'm immensely grateful for. So thank you, Kateri, for your work, for your teaching, and for taking your time to share these experiences and inspire others today.
Thank you, Allison. I really appreciate it. Yeah, this has been great. Thank you.
You're welcome.